Up front next, breaking news, new aftershocks rattling New York and New Jersey after a rare northeast earthquake. Residents told to remain indoors, entire region on edge at this hour. And more breaking news, the U.S. is preparing for a significant attack by Iran, targeting American and Israeli assets. Plus, only on Out Front, a startling warning from a former Russian minister saying Putin is so desperate to get Biden out of office that he's looking to do something in summer or early fall to harm Biden's reelection chances. Let's go Out Front. And good evening, I'm Erin Burnett. Out Front tonight, the breaking news. There are new aftershocks just rocking the Northeast, the tremors following what was the strongest earthquake to hit New York in 140 years. Buildings across America's largest city were shaken by the quake. It was 4.8. The tremors so powerful at one point that you can actually see the Statue of Liberty swaying. You could certainly feel them through your body, but to move that statue gives you a signal of the power. The epicenter of the quake was just west of the city, and that is where some of the most dramatic pictures are coming into CNN. As of tonight, there have been 11 formal aftershocks, prompting officials in New York City tonight to advise people to remain indoors, call 911 if injured. In New Jersey, some people have been forced to evacuate their homes over fears of structural damage. Today's earthquake also disrupting transportation across the Northeast. For hours, flights were grounded, flights circling in the air, unable to land during a ground stop at Newark. And trains along Amtrak's busiest line were delayed while crews inspected the rails to make sure there wasn't serious damage. And tonight, officials are warning the aftershocks are not over. Jason Carroll is live in New York for us. Chad Myers is at the Weather Center tracking the aftershocks as we are feeling them. And I want to begin first with you, Jason. We all did just experience a 4.0 aftershock where you are, where I am. What was that like where you're standing?
Well, it's pretty much been business as usual here in Times Square, but that's not to say there haven't been a few rattled nerves. You mentioned that aftershock. We heard from the mayor's office. Their spokesperson said that they felt the aftershock where they are. Aftershocks, something that's pretty common after an earthquake, just not something that's commonly felt here.
It shook pictures off walls in this home in Middlesex, New Jersey, and had many dogs and at least one cat running for cover. And had some East Coast residents like this one in Bridgewater, New Jersey, questioning exactly what had happened.
Who's that?
The magnitude 4.8 quake hit at 10:23 a.m., according to the U.S. Geological Survey. Its epicenter, near Lebanon, New Jersey, located about 50 miles west of New York City. It was the strongest to hit New Jersey since before it was even a state, 1783, the year the U.S. defeated Great Britain and won the Revolutionary War.
Is this an earthquake?
The quake felt as far north as Maine. Residents also reported feeling it in Pennsylvania, Vermont, New Hampshire, Connecticut, and Washington, D.C. The tremor temporarily caused a ground stop at all three major airports surrounding New York City. Three homes in Newark, New Jersey, had to be evacuated due to structural damage, though no reports of major damage or injuries in the tri-state area.
New Yorkers should go about their normal day. First responders are working to make sure the city's safe.
The event, anything but business as usual for people in a city and region of the country not accustomed to the ground suddenly shifting beneath their feet.
Me and my colleague were on the 83rd floor of 30 Hudson Yards, and so we got a pretty good shake.
For the train, because it was very weird to feel an earthquake.
Given the vast critical infrastructure of the region, New York's governor says structural engineering teams dispatched to inspect the city's bridges, tunnels, and subways.
We are going to be reviewing all potentially vulnerable infrastructure sites throughout the state of New York that is critically important in the aftermath of an event like this.
And while the quake didn't last long, 10 seconds or so by some accounts, it left an impression with those who felt it.
And Erin, it should be noticed that so far there have been 11 aftershocks, most of them too small to be felt like anyone. But again, it's another reminder that there are fault lines on the eastern seaboard and they do move. Erin?
All right. Thank you very much, Jason Carroll. Chad Myers, as I mentioned, standing by for us as well. So, Chad, 4.0 magnitude aftershock is coming 8 hours after the initial 4.8, which was felt as many of us felt it right throughout the Northeast. So could more aftershocks be coming, and could they be big?
I think 4.0 is probably as big as we're going to get. The rest will be likely smaller, but it's not out of the question that we could go to 4.5. And then if we go higher than that, then this doesn't become an aftershock. It becomes the foreshock here, because obviously now it could be larger than this. We got 4.8, but it was only 3 miles deep. It means that Earth really shook. This felt like, if you weren't there, it felt like riding an old wooden roller coaster. It was just a violent little shaking and not that rolling thing where buildings are really swaying.
Yeah.
This was truly a shaking, like grabbing you by the back of the neck and just giving you a big shake. But tell you what, worldwide, we get so many thousands of earthquakes that are this large every single year, like 13,000. Even on this map, there's 765 between 4.0 and 5.0 on my map right now in the past 30 days. But look where they are, the ring of fire. And then all of a sudden, boop, there he is. One little guy there in New York City. So that's a rare, rare event, even though we get thousands of these a year, not here in this area. And it was the largest for a very long time, the third largest, although I'm not sure back in the 1700s what kind of equipment they truly had. A lot of people felt some shaking, you know?
Fair. No, yeah, right. An important point to make, Chad. All right, thank you. And I like the roller coaster analogy from Chad. I described it, Chad, as sort of... to me, it felt like sitting on top of a washing machine when it was on spin.
Yeah.
You know, boo.
Right. With one rug in it, right?
Yeah, right. Exactly. All right. Chad, thank you very much. I want to go now to Maureen Long, a seismologist. And Maureen, you know, as Chad was pointing out, it appears at this point that you know, he was like, you could get an aftershock up to 4.5. Mostly they'll get smaller. And that if something really comes along bigger, then what we experienced today would have been a foreshock. Which, you know, makes people watching pause, I would think. What is the possibility of something like that?
Yeah, so the U.S. Geological Survey put out a forecast of aftershocks this morning, shortly after the magnitude 4.8. At the time, they were predicting there was about a 50% chance of an aftershock of magnitude 3 or larger. And as we saw about an hour ago, we did indeed see a magnitude 4.0 aftershock. The most likely scenario is that we will see some aftershocks continuing in the days, maybe even weeks to come. The most likely scenario is that 4.0 aftershock that we felt just recently will be the largest one. However, there is a small chance that there will indeed be a larger earthquake, an earthquake larger than that 4.8. That is not the most likely scenario. The chance of that happening is less than 1%, but it is something that folks in the area should be aware of, and we should all know what to do if we feel strong earthquake shaking.
So let me ask you about something else that stands out about this, because when you say there's a less than 1% chance, people look at that map of the ring of fire and then this one random dot, and they say, okay, well, something really unexpected that, you know, really shouldn't be happening like this just happened. So what should I think? I mean, obviously by global standards, as Chad pointed out, this is not a big earthquake, right? It's nothing compared to what they just went through in Taiwan as another example. But you know, you also have one today. There was, in amidst all this, people may not have noticed, in Tonga, in the Pacific, there was a 5.6 earthquake. Some people are linking all of this together. Is there any reason to believe there's any connection between any of it?
Well, it's certainly a good question and a very natural question to ask, but the answer really is no. You know, as you've noted already, the Earth experiences a lot of earthquakes, and this was not the biggest earthquake in the world today, not by a long shot. It is, of course, unusual for this region, which is why for those of us who live in the greater New York area, and I felt the earthquake myself in New Haven, Connecticut, it feels very unusual because it is unusual for us. But on a global perspective, a magnitude 4.8 earthquake is not unusual, and certainly in places places like California or Taiwan, as we saw with the magnitude 7.4 earthquake earlier, you know, earlier this week. Those are places that are used to more earthquakes than we see here in eastern North America.
Absolutely. And I wanted to play something for you that the seismologist Marco Brenna, he's from the University of Otago in New Zealand, before this happened, but recently in the past couple months, he did an interview with NPR, and he was talking about whether the severe weather events that have become, you know, you're going to have severe weather out west, you had severe weather this week in the east, whether there's any relationship between that and some of these other events. And here's what he told NPR.
That increasing recurrence of these weather events might be subconsciously increasing natural disasters like earthquakes and volcanoes, but it's totally different systems.
What do you think, Maureen?
Well, this is a question that scientists certainly are studying, but as yet, we do not have strong evidence or really much evidence that weather, you know, directly affects tectonics. And this, you know, this event was a tectonic event. And we expect there's really no indication that weather affects that. There are, you know, some mechanisms where weather and climate can affect earthquakes. For example, in places where we are, you know, pumping groundwater out of the earth very, very quickly, say, that can sometimes change the stress state and trigger small earthquakes. However, for this particular earthquake that we saw today, there's every indication that this was a tectonic earthquake and was not affected by the weather or climate.
All right. Well, Maureen, thank you very much. Really fascinating and learn a lot just having the conversation. So thank you.
Of course. Good to be with you.
All right. And next, we have more breaking news. Trump's legal team has just come out with a new filing, trying to remove the judge in his New York hush money case, which is set to go to trial in just days. There's a specific reason he's trying to do it. We're going to explain. And also breaking this hour, we have new reporting that the United States is preparing for what they are calling a, quote, significant, that's their word, and also their word, inevitable attack by Iran, an attack that they say could come within days. We have new reporting on that, and another major setback in efforts to free hostages being held in Gaza. Hamas now rejecting Israel's latest proposal. The parents of an American who is still being held by Hamas in Gaza tonight will be out front.
This podcast is supported by Sleep Number. Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores? Sleep Number does that. Only Sleep Number Smart Beds let you each choose your ideal comfort and support, your Sleep Number setting. Sleep Number Smart Beds learn how you sleep and provide personalized insights to help you sleep better. All Sleep Number smart beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. Temperature-balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life...
I'm sorry that the Great Barrier Reef is no longer great, that we value Amazon much more than the Amazon, and that the waterfront neighborhood where you were growing up could be condemned by rising seas before you're old enough to apply for a mortgage.
That's my friend Bill Weir, CNN's chief climate correspondent. He's optimistic about the planet, and he's optimistic about our ability to take care of it. Listen to Chasing Life wherever you get your podcasts.
Breaking news, a new court filing by former President Trump just made public. Trump's team arguing the judge in Trump's criminal hush money case should be recused. Among the reasons, Judge Juan Merchan's daughter, who Trump has been focused on for more than a year now.
I have a Trump-hating judge with a Trump-hating wife and family whose daughter worked for Kamala Harris and now receives money from the Biden-Harris campaign and a lot of it.
Now, Merchan's daughter has been employed by a company that did work for Democratic political candidates. It is unclear what role she played. Out front now, Ryan Goodman, our legal analyst, Basil Smichel, former executive director of the New York State Democratic Party, and David Urban. Trump's 2020 senior campaign advisor. All right, thanks to all of you. So, Ryan, let me just start with you because you've had a chance to go through the exact allegations that are being made by Trump as to why Juan Merchant should be recused because of his daughter. What do you make of it?
I think the motion is on a road to nowhere. Part of the reason is that the core of the motion is the idea that it's not that she directly financially benefits or is even related to a party to the case, but rather her company's clients sent out solicitations for money that refer to the case. So it's not even her company, but their clients.
So her company's client.
Correct.
Just to make state the obvious, that's something her company does not control what they do.
Yes, there's no direct link in the motion. Second is all of those almost all of those solicitations occurred way back in 2023. The lawyers actually in mid-2023 already tried to get the judge to recuse, and they said in that very motion, oh, the clients of the company could refer to the case. So they've made the argument. The idea that they would now make the argument on the eve of the trial about to start again, I think the judge will refuse it out of hand almost. In fact, they have to make arguments as to what's changed, what are the circumstances that have changed, and they don't refer to the fact that the solicitations are new or their discovery is new because they can't.
So, all right, so you're saying it just simply doesn't add up, and it doesn't add up under New York law or New York precedent. Nonetheless, David, Trump is making a play, right, that this will, his effort to do this will matter at least in the court of public opinion.
Yeah, listen, I think, you know, Ryan's probably perhaps correct on the legal aspects here. But let's not forget that what Judge Marchand did do in the past, and he should probably recuse himself for, is three donations that he made. And I just want to make sure I get them correct because they're important. One, to the Progressive Turnout Project. Two, Biden for President. And then three, to an organization, Stop Republicans, which describes its purpose as resisting the Republican Party and Donald Trump's right-wing legacy, right? So he did make those three donations.
He did. Now, hold on. One point, David. Let me just add, just for so the full thing is in there. I believe they were $10 each for progressive voters and Stop Republicans.
But it does. Okay.
I understand your point. I'm just putting the numbers out there. Go ahead.
Okay. Yep. Okay. So under the ABA model rules for judicial conduct, as well as the New York State ethics rules, any political activity is forbidden and requires recusal. Any. It doesn't say $10. It doesn't say $100. It doesn't say $1,000. It says any. And as Ryan knows and as Basil knows, because he's a smart guy, when these things are written, they're written purposefully. And that word any was in there. It didn't say there wasn't a dollar threshold. So he should recuse himself because it gives, if it's not facially a conflict, it gives the appearance of a conflict. And I'm sure there's another judge in Manhattan that could try this case without presenting such a blatant appearance of a conflict.
All right, hold on. Ryan, I'm going to give you a chance to respond. What do you make of that?
So some of these arguments have already been made before. That might be there's something of a good argument on either side, but the New York State Committee on Judicial Ethics weighed in, and they actually said you've got a green light here. You do not need to recuse yourself, including for the company and for the judge's daughter. So the judge cited that before in August of 2023. So there needs to be something new here. And the brief, like in trying to make something new, says, oh, well, something new is that the judge just recently gave an interview. But the quotes out of the interview are the judge saying things like, I will try to abide by the law. I've really prepared myself for the case.
So, all right. So, Basil.
Yeah, but what about the appearance portion?
That's not an appearance. So if the Committee for Judicial Ethics, which is made up of...
I'm saying appearance of a conflict, Ryan.
Right, but if the Committee for the Judicial Ethics says that these things don't create a conflict, then it's hard for you to come around and say, well, the appearance of them might create a conflict. If the relationships were true...
Come on.
Right, but I guess, Basil, I want to give you a chance to weigh in here. And maybe, David, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but you're back to the court of public opinion. Right?
Yes,
so, Basil,
absolutely.
Is there a point to be made there? Separate from the fact that there's not a conflict and that the ethics have weighed in and all of everything, you know, if the T's are crossed and the I's are dotted, Basil, the perception in the public eye.
You know, I understand the argument that you don't want any political activity, but to me, this all of this is about accountability, right? So if you act, if you're saying, and as Ryan has said, that there's a committee that looked at this and said, you know what, there's not a problem. I've been a government worker. I've had committees of ethics look over my work and the things that I may be involved with outside of that specific job. If they look at it, see there's a problem, I get reprimanded or removed. And I think that level of accountability is really what we're talking about at the heart of all of Donald Trump's cases, right? It's always been about accountability. I don't think that this rises to the level of recusal. In fact, I think it just really goes into Donald Trump's constant tactic, which is delay and in part intimidate. Mm-hmm. And as was said before, this trial was about to go forward. So this is, seems to be sort of a last-ditch effort to try to extend that time a little longer.
But Aaron, ahead, what you want, listen, this is such a high-profile case, right? What, you're telling me you can't find a judge in Manhattan that doesn't have a daughter who is a partisan political activist and who hasn't made political donations. There's got to be one, right? And so I would think that if you're Basil or somebody on the other side of the aisle, you'd say, listen, let's find somebody so these guys can't complain about anything. Let's find somebody with a stainless reputation who has no political activity. Maybe it's impossible in Manhattan. I don't know.
Would it be worth that, Ryan, to break the precedent or to go against the ethics for that?
I kind of think the opposite. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Oh, just that I think that's
I was just going to say the big issue here
hold on,
is
I'll
that.
Just, go ahead, sorry. Ryan, then I'll give you the final word, Basil.
Yeah, very quickly. I think that's actually what the Committee on Judicial Ethics is worried about. They would be worried about the idea that we would even think that judges are political because of what their family members do. Mm-hmm. That's part of the bright line. They actually say what a family member wants to do, they can be involved in politics. And that shouldn't impugn our courts. It's wrong to impugn our courts, even to suggest that is an appearance of impropriety or politics. It's not. The judge is doing his job.
And a quick final word is promised, Basil.
No, it's actually that. It's exactly the point I was going to make, that what we're doing here is digging into the judge's family. This is really not just about the judge. This is more of a dig into the judge's family. And that, to me, is where this territory gets really dangerous, really shady, really problematic. And that's why I feel like, you know, even if you want to say, is there another judge out there that we can look at? I'm fine with this judge. What I'm not fine with is going after the judge's family. That's the bright line that I don't think we should cross.
All right. Well, it's a thought-provoking conversation. Just thinking. Thank you all very much. And next, the breaking news on Iran. CNN is learning that the United States is preparing for what they are calling a significant attack by Iran in the coming days. Plus, only on Out Front, a former Russian minister warning tonight that Putin is so desperate to have Biden lose that he's looking to harm his reelection this summer or early fall with specific action. We have breaking news. The United States is bracing for a, quote, significant, that word is the quote from the government, also inevitable, they say, attack by Iran as soon as within the next week. The source on this is a senior administration official telling our own MJ Lee. Officials believe both U.S. and Israeli personnel and assets in the Middle East will be targeted. Iranians have been promising retaliations for that strike in Syria, in which two of its top commanders were killed, including one who replaced the one that was killed in the strike authorized by former President Trump. MJ Lee broke this story, as I said, and she is out front at the White House. MJ, these are very sobering words to talk about, that this is inevitable, that it is perhaps imminent. What more are you learning?
Yeah, Aaron, we are learning tonight that the U.S. is on high alert for what could be this significant attack by Iran and that it could come as soon as within the next week. Now, this attack, as you said, would be in response to that Israeli airstrike that killed in Damascus, that killed a number of top commanders, Iranian commanders. And of course, U.S. and Israeli officials that we are talking to say that they are fully preparing for what might be coming, but that they don't know exactly at this moment in time what form that attack would take place. Now, as of Friday, we are told that officials don't know exactly what is to come, but that it could come in a number of different forms and that it is both U.S. and Israeli assets and personnel in the region that are potentially at risk. Now, a direct strike on Israel would, of course, be incredibly worrisome for the U.S., especially because it would have the effect of escalating de-escalating a situation in the Middle East that is already so tumultuous. And what the U.S. has, of course, wanted to avoid for so many months now is a situation where the Israel-Hamas war ends up broadening out into a bigger regional conflict. Now, the U.S., we are also told, has directly warned Iran that it should not come after U.S. assets in the region. Aaron.
All right. Thank you very much, MJ Lee. Also tonight, the context here is more questions than answers still about the Israeli military strike in which seven humanitarian aid workers were killed in Gaza. There's still questions even after the release of an internal report by Israel that tried to explain what happened. Nick Robertson is out front.
The IDF's timeline. A catalogue of errors unfolding over 45 minutes. Misidentification of the vehicles, misclassification of the event, culminating in the deadly strikes at 11:09 p.m., 11:11, and 11:13 Monday night.
This operational misidentification and misclassification was the result of internal failures.
This, the IDF's first public report, explaining why they killed seven World Central Kitchen aid workers, admitting a grave mistake.
The soldiers conducted the strike without any awareness that these were in fact WCK vehicles. At the time, they were certain that they were targeting Hamas.
The investigation found that the forces identified a gunman on one of the aid trucks, following which they identified an additional gunman. After the vehicles left the warehouse where the aid had been unloaded, one of the commanders mistakenly assumed that the gunmen were located inside the accompanying vehicles. In a separate briefing, adding more detail and specificity to the public report, the IDF told journalists that they had misidentified something slung over the shoulder of one of the passengers, mistakenly thinking it was a weapon. On closer examination, they discovered it was a bag. They also described in harrowing detail how the aid workers had fled from the first vehicle when it was hit to another vehicle, only to be killed seconds later. World Central Kitchen have described the report as cold comfort for the outrageous killing of their staff, whom they say the IDF acknowledges followed all proper communications procedures. Adding video the IDF showed them fails to show any cause to fire on our personnel. The United States withholding judgment on the report.
We're reviewing it very carefully. We'll be discussing its conclusions with Israeli officials and with humanitarian organizations in the days to come. It's very important that Israel is taking full responsibility for this incident.
Two commanders fired, a major and a reserve colonel. Three others disciplined, triggering pushback from hardline ministers and pushback from the UN Secretary General.
The essential problem is not who made the mistakes. Fixing those failures requires independent investigations and meaningful and measurable changes on the ground.
Well, I don't think there's any expectation here that there's going to be an independent investigation, but this sense of growing international pressure does seem to be taking root. The Prime Minister's office is saying that this is just a preliminary investigation, that there will be more details to come. And they're saying this won't be in a few months' time. They're saying this should happen really over the next few days, perhaps weeks. Aaron?
All right, Nick, thank you very much. Live in Israel tonight. And in another major development this hour, we're learning Hamas is rejecting Israel's latest counterproposal to free the remaining hostages who have been held captive in Gaza for nearly 6 months. The latest setback comes after protests have erupted in Israel. Anger over the inability to free the hostages has been reaching a boiling point. Out front now, Israeli-American Jonathan Dekel-Hen and his wife, Gillian Kay. Jonathan's son, Sagi, who also has dual citizenship, has been held captive by Hamas for 182 days. So it's 6 months on Sunday since Sagi was ripped from his home, from his young family. He's had a baby born since then. Life has continued. And here we are. Could you ever have imagined 6 months later that he would not be home?
No, it would have been impossible to imagine. You know, I think we try not, if possible, not to think in those terms, but to take every day as a new challenge. And perhaps the day that we can move the needle just enough to get the hostages home.
And Gillian, the protests I mentioned, we've seen the largest protests so far. I mean, there have been all the way along, but it has gotten more and more intense in Israel in recent weeks. It's frustration at Prime Minister Netanyahu because he has not been able to secure the release of the hostages. Some of the protesters outside the Prime Minister's home in Jerusalem were physically confronted, overpowered by police. What do you think when you see these images, the protests, when you see how the protesters are being treated? How do you even process that?
I think it's inevitable. It's inevitable that the anger, the fear, it's impossible. It's 183 days today. 3 days today. And I think it's inevitable that it would happen. I think we understand it has to happen, that the pressure needs to continue to ramp up and ramp up. There's no waiting anymore, right? It has to happen. I do think there's been a confluence, as you know, in Israel of somewhat of the anti-government protesting and the protesting around the hostages and the hostage families. You're just seeing rage.
Rage. And Jonathan, the tragedy here, when we talk about what happened with the aid workers and these horrible things that are happening, it's the situation inside Gaza, where Sagi is, where people are being killed, is unfathomably horrible. People are starving. There's an aid worker, Mahmoud Shalabi. He'd been sending us dispatches from Gaza, and honestly, we hadn't heard from him in a little while, and we didn't know. We were worried, and we actually got a voice note from him today. First one in a little while. I just wanted to share it with you. This is what he actually saw today and sent us. Here it is.
It's really difficult. We are struggling to secure food. We are struggling to secure water. There is no power. There is no infrastructure. The health system has collapsed, officially has collapsed after the destruction of Shifa.
What goes through your mind when you hear that? I mean, just the suffering of people, Sagi being there.
I don't think any decent-minded person in Israel or anywhere else can be anything but horrified by the conditions that the people of Gaza have had to endure these many months. I completely understand why they are so full of fear for themselves, for their children. But here's the other truth. We've gotten here after 6 months because of a massacre on October 7th, in which 1,400 Israelis, men, women, and children, from my kibbutz alone, from our kibbutz community alone, 40 people were murdered from 2 years old to mid-70s. It's that massacre by Hamas has set off a horrific chain of events, horrific, where no one benefits. And the people of Gaza are being held as captive by Hamas as my son and the other 134 Israeli hostages. And the sad truth is that until they come home, we hope alive, but we really don't know. Until they come home, there is no way to move forward towards any peaceful, rational resolution and to relieve this horror that the people of Gaza have to live through every day.
Gillian, are you hearing anything from the Israeli government, from the U.S. government, anything specific about where this is, about Sagi, or about that makes you believe that it could possibly be a deal at any point to get the hostages home?
I don't think we're hearing anything different than we've heard all along. Yeah. I really, you know, we've done this countless times. I have to underscore the commitment of the Biden administration has been real and true from the very beginning of all of this. You know that. Our engagement with them, the transparency, the kind of fortitude to really keep the hostages front and center, I don't think that that's changed. I do think that it's become more complicated now. But of course, we need action. We need something to happen. That's what we want. Whatever it takes, we need it to happen. But I don't think that that's changed.
Well, at least that's something. It's not It's not much, but it's something important.
That's what we have.
Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for keeping this front and center.
Thank you so much.
There'll be a time we will talk in a very different circumstance.
We hope so.
And next, a former Russian minister tells OutFront that Putin is desperate for Trump to win and Biden to lose. Here's what he thinks Putin will do. We're going to tell you the specificity of what he thinks Putin will do to make that happen this summer. And breaking news out of Baltimore tonight, where another body has just been found after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed.
The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish. There's been a ton of writing about the album Cowboy Carter since it dropped this spring. But what grabbed my attention is a new documentary on CNN called Call Me Country, Beyoncé and Nashville's Renaissance. Lots of artists have tried to boot scoot their way onto country music charts. Why did this album cause such a stir? And what about both this pop star and this political moment has caused all this conversation? Listen to The Assignment with me, Audie Cornish, on your favorite podcast app.
Tonight, a major warning from a former Russian official under Vladimir Putin. He says Putin is so determined to stop President Biden from winning re-election that he's plotting various ways to sabotage him in the summer or early fall. A very specific warning coming from Vladimir Milov, a former Russian energy minister.
I certainly believe, like 100%, that Putin will be doing things in summer, early autumn to actually harm Biden's position ahead of the elections, be it, I don't know, some impacting the international oil market with supply disruptions so that the prices go up, U.S. gasoline becomes more expensive, there is a spike in inflation, whatever, or certain acts of sabotage using his allies like Iran or Iranian proxies in the Middle East to disturb security situation there. It can be anything. Also, the attacks in Russia's neighborhood, covert sabotage attacks that I've just mentioned. But I really think this is actually the signal that I'm getting from my sources in Moscow that Putin is so eager to get Biden out so that he will really do something to complicate his re-election and to complicate his political standing. So that's really worth expecting.
All right, out front now, Steve Hall, the former CIA chief of Russia operations. So Steve, I had that conversation with Vladimir last night. How seriously do you take his warning?
Well, I think it's a great warning, and I think it's pretty commonsensical. I mean, there is really no strong calculation, no difficult calculation for Vladimir Putin here when he has to choose between who he would rather be the next U.S. president. So the question then simply becomes, okay, how is he going to do it? I thought there was a couple of interesting points, you know, raising the oil prices, you know, thereby raising, you know, the political pressure in the United States for low gas prices, using proxies like Iran and others. Those are all interesting things. But the bottom line, Aaron, is that we know Putin and Russia can do this. They've done it in the past and in other American and non-American elections in the West. So, yeah, there's in my mind, there's no doubt he's going to give it a shot.
And you know, he has already done some of what Milov warned about, right? I mean, he interfered in U.S. elections. He's actually backed oil production cuts that raise prices for American consumers, right? So there's some ways that this is done sort of out in the open when it comes to the oil price in that instance. You know, do you think Putin even cares if he's caught this time? Because if he doesn't, does that just mean he can go further, right? That there's sort of, you know, any restraints are off.
Yeah, that was another interesting comment that Madoff made, and I think it's a good one. I, you know, when we were looking at the elections previously that Russia tried to influence and may have had some success in, they were using their intelligence services to do it covertly. This is what we would refer to in the United States as covert action. These are active measures. But they tried to have some deniability. No, it wasn't Russia that was doing these things. I think Putin doesn't really care anymore. And it's not only because of who he is and where he feels he is in the world right now, but it's also he understands that it doesn't really matter perhaps that much in the American political system because of both sides, you know, the aisle just pointing fingers at each other. Oh, it was Russia. No, it wasn't Russia. So, yeah, I think he might be a lot more brazen this time around. What's he got to lose?
It's pretty terrifying when you think about it, when you think about how disruptive it was when it was not brazen. Obviously, it makes sense of who Putin would prefer in the Trump-Biden rematch. I mean, certainly when you hear about Trump's view, for example, on Ukraine, I mean, you know, this is very simple on just a basic policy point of view. It's very, very clear. But it's interesting to just also take some time to look back at how Trump and Biden talk about Putin, right? Just as a basic gauge. And let me play some of that.
He's acted brutally. I think he's committed war crimes.
President Putin was a total gentleman.
You know Vladimir Putin. You think he's a killer?
Mm-hmm. I do.
It's a great honor to be with President Putin.
So, Steve, what does Putin actually think it would do for him? And I mean, maybe this is as simple as Ukraine, but what does he think it would actually do if Trump is president again for Putin?
Oh, it checks a whole lot of boxes for him, Aaron. I mean, you start with Ukraine. You know, what's Biden's position? More money, try to convince Congress to keep it going, rally NATO and other allies. So that box is easy because Trump says, yeah, we don't need any more money to go to Ukraine. You look at NATO, you know, Biden is very supportive of NATO. But Trump has said they're not paying their dues. It's very transactional. Wider among the allies, again, very transactional on Trump's part. Biden continues to work to try to preserve the post-World War II security structure, which Russia very much doesn't like, along with its the axis of evil allies. So, yeah, this is a no-brainer for Putin. He would much rather have Donald Trump than Joe Biden as the next president.
All right. Thank you very much, Steve Hall. And next, we do have some breaking news coming in. Crews in Baltimore have just discovered another body after the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapse. And a town of 1,000 people that is about to quadruple in size because of the eclipse. And we're going to take you there. Breaking news, crews just discovering another body where the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed. The victim, 38-year-old Maynor Yasir Suazo Sandoval. He was working on the Key Bridge when the massive cargo ship plowed into it a week ago, killing 6 people. The bodies of 3 workers are still missing tonight. And finally, tonight, out front, a tiny Texas town will soon transform into a solar eclipse central hotspot. Bandera, Texas, is in the middle of the path of totality. And with millions of people getting on the road to see the eclipse for themselves, this tiny town is about to see an epic change. Rosa Flores is out front.
Welcome to Bandera, you guys.
It's the cowboy capital of the world.
Lots of Western bands and good dancing.
Bandera, Texas is in the path of totality for Monday's solar eclipse. The town is expected to experience more than 4 minutes of darkness.
Rosa, I know you're over there, but I can't see you.
I can't see you.
Eclipse mania has taken hold of Bandera. Horses and dinosaurs are donning eclipse glasses, even eyewear for a giant cowboy.
One monster eclipse party.
We are downtown Bandera, Texas. Behind us here is the courthouse.
Bandera's population of under 1,000.
Everybody knows everybody. Hi, Eileen.
Is expected to quadruple Monday, says the mayor.
There were some folks from China in the 11th Street last night, all over the place.
At 11th Street Cowboy Bar, the meet,
medium rare,
and greet is about the eclipse.
We drove 1,700 miles.
1,700 miles to see the eclipse.
Congrats.
These two friends caravan from Pennsylvania.
I've been preparing. I bought a camper. I bought a Jeep. I did everything.
Bought a camper for the eclipse? I hear that it might storm in Bandera.
No.
It's going to be a beautiful day. Are we doing positive thinking about this? Positive thinking.
It's not just Bandera's cowgirls praying for good weather. Millions are expected to flock to Texas and more than a dozen U.S. states in the celestial path of totality. Some officials are worried about traffic jams.
And who's this? This is Rooster.
In Bandera, cowgirls solved that problem.
I'm going to jump on Rooster, and I'm going to ride by everybody, and I'll do my little princess wave even.
Eclipse mania expected to add $6 billion to the U.S. economy in one estimate. Texas' slice of the astronomical pie, $1.4 billion. The Eclipse merchandise in Bandera...
They sold like that.
...is practically sold out.
Well, this is beautiful country, Alec.
Yes, ma'am.
So are venues like the historic Dixie Dude Ranch.
And when did you start getting calls about the eclipse?
Our first reservation for the eclipse was in 2017. I think we sold out completely about 4 years ago.
What never runs out here are the good people.
And a moon pie.
Moon pie?
It's the eclipse, don't you know?
For the eclipse. Thank you.
And the good times.
And in the cowboy capital of the world, a lot of that good time, a lot of that fun happens with a hat. Some people are worried about the weather, Aaron. Perhaps some cloud cover. Not here in Bandera. People are committed to have a good time. And if I can give you my tin hat theory, I think it's going to be a good day. Aaron, back to you.
All right, Rosa, thank you very much. It is going to be a really incredible, incredible day and maybe uplifting in a way that so many in this country need. We will have special coverage of the solar eclipse on Monday. It'll be another two decades before you can see one in the United States. So tune in starting at 1 p.m. Eastern on Monday to watch it live here on CNN, also streaming on Max. And have a good weekend. Thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. AC360 is now.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.